Okay, welcome to, yes, I had to be told to use the mic. Welcome to the panel, how to get breaking, how, what to do when a big story breaks on your beat. I'm Robert McClure. I'm with Investigate West in Seattle, and I'll introduce our speakers as we go along. Thank you for the reminder about using the mic. So as I was saying, Barbara Reynolds from the CDC was going to come and discuss the we're going to talk about several different case studies, basically, and that each of these fellows has been involved in. And you will have heard of most of them. One we wanted to talk about was the West Virginia water crisis, which I think everybody knows was pretty much an unmitigated disaster as far as getting information out to the public. And one kind of encouraging thing that came out of that was that the CDC's head of communications, Barbara Reynolds, who was going to be here, said, you know, you're right. That was a disaster, and we need to do better. And since she couldn't be here, she did want me to convey some of what she has had to say about that. And so I'm going to do that, actually. She sent me some information that I think I'm going to actually just hit the bullet points here. But I think it's worth noting that we, as SEJ, the FOI Task Force, we do quite a bit of writing to government agencies, particularly EPA in many cases, but we to others as well. And in this case, we got some pretty good response, I thought. So here's what she hoped. She said, we wrote a letter to the CDC and said, you know, that did not work and you got to do better. And I'll read you an excerpt or two of that, of their response, which I thought was very good. She said, here are steps that I've taken since the start of the year to improve our relationship with SEJ members. CDC and I invited and I met with state PIO members of the National Public Health Information Coalition to describe a new way to interact with states during major public health crises in their states. Traditionally, we have deferred to states for comment and expected them to take the lead. We are using a new model that will allow CDC to respond more directly and quickly with reporters by coordinating with states to provide joint statements to delineate our roles in a way CDC can respond more rapidly about CDC-specific tasks/recommendations. I hope this will reduce the ping-pong effect that I think frustrates all of us, reporters especially. Second thing, they reviewed their CDC media policy, received a grade of A from the Union of Concerned Scientists. The policy is reasonable, and we are doing more training, conversation internally with scientists and managers to help them understand the spirit of the policy for openness. Third bullet point, proposed an SEJ boot camp at CDC to invite reporters to interact over 2 to 3 days with CDC, ATSDR, to meet with our experts and explore issues of importance. She also, I talked with her about their principles. The CDC has some communication principles, and these I can share these with you later if you'd like, but just keep these in mind if you're dealing with them. I'm going to have to call this up. But these, so if you're dealing with CDC, this is what they're supposed to be doing. Values honesty, respects peer review, sensitive to others, culturally aware, not manipulative, owns its actions, safeguards our name, recognizes opposition, speaks plainly, corrects mistakes, chooses honor, and shares its science to help. Anyway, if any of that could be helpful to you, get in touch and I can mail this to you. Okay. Yeah, good suggestion, Joe. We'll send it. What's the and the BP guy? Yeah, right. So we're since Barbara's not here, I assume we're not going to talk about West Virginia, but I did want to say she I think that CDC is actually making a pretty pretty good effort to try and set things right, and we may be seeing some of that going on in some of the other agencies too, we hope so. But what we're here for today is to talk to these three gentlemen who can tell us. I've asked them to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly on some of the big breaking stories that have gone on. Randy and Tom have both done excellent work under a lot of pressure recently on big stories over the last year or two. And Mark was actually down here for Katrina. Mark is with EPA, and he was down here for Katrina. And also, I learned this morning, was at the Enbridge spill in Michigan. So I'm going to ask, we can get to Enbridge if we get past the others. So I've asked them to talk about what their experiences were, how they got around needing to get information on a big breaking story. Randy Loftus is the environmental reporter for the Dallas Morning News, for those who do not know. And among the big stories that he has covered in the last few years are the Deepwater Horizon and the West Texas explosion. So, Randy, if you'd give us a few thoughts about those.
Great. Thanks, Robert. Good morning, everybody. As I mentioned in another panel yesterday, if you were at the disaster coverage workshop on Wednesday, and if I repeat anything, please act like it's fresh and exciting to you. I had been a young reporter. Yes, I was once a young reporter for the newspaper in Anderson, South Carolina. I had been on the job for about 10 days when a dam broke in a portion of northeast Georgia that we covered from our South Carolina paper. The dam was on a mountaintop above a Bible college, and the resulting flood instantly killed 39 people, and 20 of them were children who lived on the campus. The communications at the time were such that this was 1977. Pardon me. We didn't, of course, there was, you know, cell phones had not been imagined except on Star Trek, and there was really no way to get any information. We weren't even certain exactly where the thing had happened when somebody called us and we got in the car and went. This paper didn't even provide us with press cards until after this incident. So to get through the police line, I showed them my byline in that morning's paper and my driver's license. So that's how far away this was. Our filing method that day was to stand in line at the one payphone at the hospital that was adjacent to the college, and there were probably 50 reporters there by this time, and you know, read your notes into the telephone, and hopefully somebody back at the office could turn it into clear copy. These days, of course, we have almost instantaneous access to the fundamentals. But the real challenges remain. On April 17, 2013, a warehouse full of ammonium nitrate fertilizer in West, Texas, not the western part of the state, exploded after a fire. And it incinerated a dozen volunteer firefighters who had responded to the fire. The final death toll was 13, and the 15. I'm sorry. The property damage amounted to well over $100 million, and the government response cost many millions more. Within about an hour of my learning of this incident, I had posted a story online about what the company had told the EPA about the safety of its facility. And the company had said that the facility that just burned and blew up posed no risk of fire or explosion. Now, why could they do that? They could do that because the stuff that blew up, ammonium nitrate, was not listed by the EPA as a chemical that required a risk management plan. They had other stuff on site, a liquid fertilizer called anhydrous ammonia, that is listed because if it leaks, it doesn't blow up, but it can kill lots of people with the fumes. They reported that the anhydrous ammonia posed no risk of fire or explosion, and that's absolutely correct. But the way the form actually reads is, it's the only report that they've made, and so they're asserting that there's no problem. And, of course, there was a problem. That was an early example in the process of that story about how to get information very, very quickly, and this was outside of official communications, because the risk management plans are heavily redacted. There's a lot of security information that is not made available to the public in any kind of ready manner. But there's a nonprofit organization that goes around the country and scours all of these out of EPA libraries and posts them online anyway. And that's entirely legal. It's just a step that the EPA cannot, by law, take itself. I was able to access the NGO's website, get the information, and that became a theme of our coverage from then on. What information is available and how incomplete is that information, and in some cases, how misleading is that information? This is the kind of thing that I hope is going to encourage more and more reform. We'd like to think that the efforts that we made and a number of other outstanding organizations made were factors in President Obama's executive order of August 1, 2013, requiring a new approach to chemical emergency management and planning. As Mark can explain, the officials are frequently, they're no better off than we are when something explodes. They don't automatically know everything. They have to find out. They have to be reporters in a lot of ways. They have to scour the documents. And in the old days, it was okay to give them a day or two to do that and then for them to tell us what's going on. These days, the public is demanding instant information, and we're trying really, really hard to give them the very best information. Now, inevitably, with Twitter, as one of the guys from the National Weather Service pointed out the other day, the tweet saying the dam has broken gets around the world before we can say, no, it hasn't. And so by then, the reality for the public has become the dam is broken. In West, we had a couple of very similar situations. One was that the anhydrous ammonia had exploded. And because people knew it was there, they assumed that had exploded. Well, I knew that. It's nearly impossible to make that stuff explode. You'd have to go out of your way in a lot of ways. So we immediately started saying, no, chemically, that's just not correct. But we were trying to correct that misinformation. The other was that the fire and explosion had originated in a rail car that had delivered the product to the facility. Now, in fact, if you looked at the aerial photographs that we got almost immediately as soon as light came, you could actually see the rail car they were talking about on its side with its ammonium nitrate spilled out, but unexploded. Now, oh, absolutely. Yes.
Repeat the question.
Yes, I'm sorry. The question is, are we monitoring Twitter all the time to catch these errors and try to correct them? Absolutely. That's a responsibility we didn't have when I began in this work, but we certainly have it now. The rail car did not explode. I think what people had thought in their minds, they had imagined this being some kind of chemical tanker car. And so maybe a rail car blew up. Well, this is like trying to blow up a hopper car full of gravel. It just can't happen. So we were able to correct that. That was perpetuated by the chairman of our state environmental agency, who said, "Well, I've heard that maybe it was a rail car," and we, you know, so my editors are saying the chairman of the TCEQ says it was a rail car, and I said, "Well, the chairman of the TCEQ is wrong," and we wrote that. We just said, "No, he's wrong. The rail car didn't blow up." So the overall point of this is we can't rely on official sources of information in the early hours of a disaster because it's not because they're obscuring, it's not because they're hiding, it's because they don't have the information already. We have a positive obligation now to go out and scour the information ourselves. We really have to be part of the communication process and not just the receiver of information. And we'll talk about some details about that a little later, But that's the main thing I want to emphasize, that you've got to grab the story yourself and force the information into the public sphere and not just hang around waiting.
Thanks, Randy. Appreciate that. You did also cover Deepwater Horizon, so if we get to that in questions, that would be fine. I've known Mark McIntyre for about 15 years since I moved to Seattle. He is a PIO who I've come to trust and like. And I was interested to hear, I did not know this, we're not in that close of touch anymore since I've started Investigate West, but I was interested to learn that he actually had been down here for Katrina. And I asked him to give a little bit of pull away the curtain and let everyone in the room see what a PIO is up against when they're working one of these big breaking situations.
Thanks a lot, Robert. First, I'd just like to say how happy I am to be here and how honored I am to be sharing this table with some of my reporter heroes. It's an interesting business being in the information dissemination cadre at a big event, especially one like Katrina. Just a little short background on me. I've worked at the EPA since 1992 in Seattle. Prior to that, I worked for the state agency, the Washington Department of Ecology, since 1990. And prior to that, I worked in various public relations capacities back to 1979 in Manhattan in New York. So I have a kind of long and checkered career in both private sector and public sector. I like public sector a lot more. If that's worth anything. But getting to what we're talking about here today, I think one of the one of the most difficult challenges I face as a spokesperson for the EPA and someone who is occasionally called upon to organize joint information centers or be a joint information center manager for multiple jurisdictions, at a place like Katrina or a place like the Enbridge pipeline or the Alyeska pipeline up in Fairbanks, is this sense of trying to bring order from chaos. When you get to these scenes, I usually get called, frankly, I find out about things from reporters, which is why I like them so much, because inevitably my phone at my desk will ring and somebody will say, you know, are you guys responding to this gigantic thing that just blew up or rail car that just came off the tracks or whatever it happens to be, which, you know, always kind of takes you a little bit aback, you know, and I, you know, I'll say, I don't have the latest information on that right now, but let me check in with my responders. And then I make a furious call to a couple of people I know and say, why do I always have to hear about these from reporters? So, but that's a whole other story. Notification is a kind of a big bugaboo among every PIO I've ever worked with has always carped about notification when we find out about things and how quickly we have to kind of make up ground. But when I'm asked to go to Fairbanks, to Kalamazoo, Michigan, inevitably, what I try to do when I get there is rather than, you know, portray some kind of the cavalry is here or the grown-ups have arrived so the kids can kind of now stand back, is just simply to go up to the Joint Information Center person who's ever in charge there and just say, how can I help you? You know, what can I add? You know, here's where I am, here's who I am, here's where I'm from. I just dumped all my stuff in the corner over there. What can I do to help this work better? And I think that makes a big difference with sort of setting the tone of what your relationship's going to be in the JIC or the Unified Command or whatever it happens to be. And when I got to Katrina, I got here in November, so it had really been rolling for a while. I was not a sod buster at Katrina. I came in and there had been, I think, three shifts of PIOs in my job before I got here. But when I got here, we were in Metairie, out at the Technical College there in Metairie, and they had established kind of a Camp Kilo of fifth wheels and things for us to live in, and it was like a big compound. And what I wanted to try to do was I knew that most of the story of Katrina had already been told at that point, but I knew that there was going to be an interest on the part of reporters to continue to tell the story because it was still an unfolding story at that point. So what I tried to do was kind of give reporters, give TV, give AP, give them a picture. Like, they needed a picture for what they were trying to do. And so I tried to create events, create availabilities, coordinate access to people who knew what was happening in the field. And fortunately for me, the niche that I had was the other folks in the public information, sort of in our joint information center, they were distracted by a lot of other things, a lot of sort of nuts and bolts management of the operation. And so that enabled me to do more things like, we've got this really cool household hazardous waste management thing going down at Fort Jackson, down in Plaquemines Parish. I'd like to see if I get some reporters in there to take a look at what we're doing. They had acres and acres there of staged bottles and containers and canisters. And so I kind of did what I could to find things for reporters to come and cover for their needs. An AP reporter approached me, and I got him out to Plaquemines to do a big photo essay on the drums that had washed up in the storage tanks and all that had been turned up in the woods and the weeds and everything from the storm surge. So I guess for me, one of the biggest challenges or things that I can reveal from behind the curtain in the Joint Information Center world and being a JIC manager is that I can say without exception that all the operations that I worked in were desperately trying to provide the best information they could as soon as they could, given that same thing with Kalamazoo River and Enbridge. I was well into the response by the time I got there. So we're constrained, as everybody is, in terms of how quickly we can turn stuff around. And we understand that everybody wants it and needs it now because of the way the news business works now. But it's that struggle over timing and speed with which we provide information. All the information centers I've worked in have never been willing to sacrifice what we consider to be the quality of the information for it to meet some deadline. That we will always, if given the choice between being absolutely right and okay. Thank you.
It's the crew shot.
All right. the operations that I work in will never sacrifice quality of information for timing. And I will never advocate that we go out early with something just because people want it now. And I've been in situations where I've had to make reporters wait for interviews when I know they're really unhappy. And I didn't feel good about it. I felt really bad about it, but I also knew that I wasn't going to put somebody on camera that wasn't ready to go. So as you've heard many times here, it's really a relationship business, and it's building a relationship with PIOs and getting to know us and what drives us and what we struggle with that will help you, I would suggest, be more successful at incidents and scenes. And I don't know, I've committed my career to, as I've said to a couple of people here, making reporters' dreams come true. And sometimes I'm successful, a lot of times I'm successful, and sometimes I'm not. But I offer anybody, if anybody would like to talk about it outside of this, I'll leave my business card. But I've dedicated my professional life to doing this. I feel really good about it. I have passion around it. And I just try to do the best job I can to get reporters what they need at the scene. So I'm not sure what else I can say.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate those remarks. Next, we'll hear from Tom Henry. Tom's covered innumerable breaking news stories going back to his career in starting in Florida, right, Tom, I think?
Basically Michigan.
Michigan, okay. Well, he's been all over the place. Tom's now with the Toledo Blade and is a really great environmental reporter. I asked him to talk this morning about the most, one of the, I guess this must be the biggest, most recent big breaking story, which was the Lake Erie toxic algae, which he knows very well. But I want, you're going to focus on I've asked him to focus on what the challenges were for getting information as that broke and how he got around them, which he did very well.
Thanks, Robert. I'm not going to go through too much of the history of the water crisis. I hope most of you have heard about it. A state senator said that he knew it was a big story when somebody emailed him and said, is Toledo's water really as screwed up as they're reporting over here in Africa? Anyways, I just wanted to start this off with a show of hands. How many people know the name of their local water plant operator? Good. How many know the cell phone number? How many also? How many people, taking it another level, know the name of the chief chemist at their local water plant? These are the kind of people that are very, they're untapped resources. They're obviously very essential in a breaking story like this. I had the I had a little bit of an advantage with the Toledo water crisis in the sense that we had, I'd been covering algae for 19 years, and as Peter Dykstra had pointed out, nobody seemed to be reading my stories up until the Toledo water crisis, but 19 years of I told you so, this could happen. But there was a little bit of a mini crisis the last fall, last September. A little county just east of us had a small township named Carroll County, where it was the first time in Ohio's history that a water treatment plant became so overwhelmed by this toxin that it had to shut down. I did a little feature on the plant operator there. His name's Henry Biggert, and it's a small township, one of the smaller water plants, municipal water plants in Ohio, but he just said, you know, I could have waited for the Ohio EPA, I could have waited for all these different lines of, you know, people to go through. He just said, I knew in my heart it was the right thing to do, and so I just shut it down, whether, you know, and looking back, it was the right decision, and basically took it upon himself to shut it down. So I did a story about that, focusing on one guy who just went on his instinct there. And lo and behold, I always thought water plant operators were going to be kind of a tough nut to crack because, they're scientists. They don't have a lot of dealings with the media or the public on a normal basis. Lo and behold, coincidentally, we had a American Water Works Association Ohio chapter conference about 2 weeks later, and I was welcomed as almost like a rock star going into this conference. I just decided to go and introduce myself to a few people. Because of that event, I spent 8 hours out at the Toledo Water Plant, and it was not the first time. I'd been there several other times before. I've always felt as a reporter, part of your obligation is to, you know, maybe not to the degree of an engineer, but at least know the technology or try to get a rudimentary understanding of it, the technology or the science. And, I mean, that involves, you got to make the investment. I've been out at the local water treatment plant now several times, enough that reporters come to me as we had recently and saying, you know, can you explain to me what just happened and so forth. I've been, you know, Prima might know, at the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant enough times that First Energy Corporation has said to me, why don't you just start running our tours, you know. So at least, you know, if you can get a general understanding of how the technology works, who the players are, these are pretty basic fundamental things. But when the Toledo water crisis hit, and granted, nobody had ever gone down this path, both both in Carroll County and Toledo, I thought it was interesting, the way they notified the public was the instantaneous notification was by Facebook. In Carroll Township and Toledo's, state of emergency was declared at 2 in the morning. By 3 in the morning, almost all bottled water within 100 miles was sold out. People were going out in the middle of the night and buying up the water. I just found it, social media, the power of social media and Facebook. And a lot of people got upset because it's like, what if you're not trolling Facebook, you're not on Facebook, and so forth. And there's the whole communications aspect now is being reexamined. But I thought the first day it was important to not just, hang out with the TV outside of the command center and wait for the occasional bureaucrat to come out and make a statement. I wanted to get inside the plant. I said, that's where the action is. And my plan was to take my laptop and get authorization, get inside the plant, and report the results as they were coming in. They're trying to get the community back online. We have a few newsroom theatrics when I came in. I had one of the senior editors screaming and yelling and saying, just go out there and just hang out, get outside the gate, demand to go in. I said, look, you guys don't understand. Water plants are one of the most heavily guarded things since 9/11. You just don't hang out. I said, I can go out there if you guys want to do this. We're going to be wasting a lot of time. I said, let me work my sources. I have cell phones for some of these people. And, like any other weekend, people were doing, the water plant operator, his name's Andy McClure, he was seeing family in Buffalo, he was racing to come back, and I called the chief chemist, she said, sweetie, I'd love to let you in, but this has got to go up the administration to the mayor or somebody. So I just told him, I assured everybody, I said, I know people in the city administration well enough. I made the case that this is a major story. I know more about this, from an environmental standpoint than anybody else, and it needs to be told from the inside. I said, give me a couple hours, and sure enough, they authorized me to come in. They were so uptight that they didn't even want to sit down and do an interview. I just interviewed them while they were walking around doing tests and, continued to be stressed out. We had our chief chemist, Brenda Snyder, worked 40 consecutive hours without a break. I mean, they were just really, really stressed about this. But, it's like hurricane planning. You make a plan, but you never know how it's going to go in real life when you hit the ground running. The next day, the National Wildlife Federation did a very media savvy thing. They just happened to have their president and CEO in Ann Arbor. For another event, and they arranged for a boat ride out near the Toledo water intake crib, and I figured, okay, we'll get some visuals. We gotta do something. But I didn't really expect it to be as thick as it was. We went out there and with a few other media, and we were kind of caught in between the governors coming up from Columbus and so forth. We go out there, and it was like thick green paint surrounding the intake crib. And I told my boss, I said, the story is not about, bureaucrats going up and giving you promises at a microphone at the command center. I said, if you were on the lake, you'd be wondering how that didn't get in there, not how it did, it just was really intense, and you guys may have seen some of the pictures of how it all congregated and blew down into the intake there. So, learn the technology. There are great sources that we always think of the EPA, we think of the government, the regulators, but some of the American Water Works Association, a lot of reporters probably have never heard, probably have never dealt with. They've got great resources. It's all, it's science-based from the industry standpoint. They seem to be very willing and, to deal with help with reporters, but I guess I'll just leave it there. There's a lot of other stories going on. One of the most fundamental with Mark's agency is all the water plant operators. have this sense of anxiety because there's no federal rule on how to test. They want to know not only what works best, but why it works best, because you just can't, as one of the local operators said, you just can't nuke everything with more chemicals and, you know, more of everything, because you could have unintended consequences, or one could work against each other or let something else through the system. One operator's name's Kelly Fry, he's the Ottawa County Sanitary Engineer. He testified before a legislative caucus that I covered, and he said that, we don't know what works and why. We're waiting for the US EPA to develop standards, to develop more research. I hate to say this, but when I need more information, I Google another country. I Google what's going on in Australia. I Googled, because he said the problem is way ahead of the technology in our country right now and our understanding of it. And, he's very passionate about trying to, because these guys are the last line of defense, and they're waiting on some more guidance from the US EPA on this. And I did a blog post on him, which was really well received. I said, here's a guy for once, going to the microphone and speaking candor about how difficult it is to do his job and trying his best to protect the public, and the support he needs trying to catch up on this breaking crisis. But
just to interrupt, so the thing that he was armed with was a United States standard about what should be. That's why.
Yeah, there still is not a standard developed, and I know Mark may want to weigh in on this, but there's. The toxin that's in the algae, it's microcystin, and it's one of, I believe it's like one of 115 different environmental toxins that are under review with the US EPA. I've been told, I interviewed the president and vice president of a company called Abraxas, which makes the test kits for the water treatment plants. And this is getting kind of wonkish and geeky, and when it gets to newspaper copy, you start to lose people, but you try to explain it as best you can. There's a debate going on between what's known as lysing and unlysing. If you lyse a water sample, you can do it a couple different ways.
I'm going to cut you off there. Wait a minute. Sorry. Let's not go there. That's too wonky even for us here.
Okay, but no, it's. I'll finish it real quick. You're cracking open the cell, trying to release the toxin to see how much is truly in there. The problem is it takes a long time to do it. So, you're caught between that, and you're also how much you quench or arrest the chlorine, all these, these different processy things. And so the bottom line, these guys at Abraxas were saying, there's not only, you're not only waiting on the standard and everything, but now because of the chaos that was happening in Toledo over all these differing results, they said every little step of the process from, how you collect the sample, how you preserve it, how you, what kind of container you use it in, all of that's going to be subject to more scientific review, and we're probably going to have even a longer waiting period. So,
okay, thanks a lot, Tom. Oh, yeah. So, know your water plant operator's advice, piece of advice number one. I have several questions that I could ask each of you, but we've gone pretty long. We've got just a little over half an hour left, so I'm actually going to go straight to the audience for questions, comments, suggestions. Yes, Peter Dykstra.
Hi.
Please say who you are and where you're from.
Tom, first of all, I'm going to nominate you for the Pulitzer Prize for I Told You So. For this. I'm Peter Dykstra. I publish Environmental Health News and the Daily Climate. When 9/11 happened, there was a renewed push from the chemical industry to fight back against right-to-know laws. That surely applies to water plants and the new plant that you cover. It surely applies to fertilizer plants, which we already knew from Oklahoma City. But I'd like to hear from any of you, and Mark particularly from you, whether it's an interagency thing. What's the latest on how security concerns are used to try and stop right-to-know efforts?
I wish I could respond, Peter, to that. I just don't. I'm not at that level in the agency. I'm aware of the issue and I've talked to people about it, but I have nothing that I could offer that would be fact-based. So I would say take this opportunity, though. Again, this is Mark McIntyre with the EPA. One suggestion that I would make to all reporters who cover incidents or who may find themselves at incidents is for everyone to contact NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and get the NIOSH Pocket Guide. And it's humorously named because nobody has pockets that they're that big that you could actually fit it in. But it's I believe, an invaluable compendium of data on toxic substances, chemicals, that I think would be really handy for everybody to have. So,
thanks. It's Randy Loftus at the Dallas Morning News. Pardon me. The lack of facts never holds me back, so I'll just I'll venture into that. A little, very, very quick background. Several years ago, the Chemical Safety Board, which is the things that blow up equivalent of the NTSB, recommended to the EPA that they list reactives, such as ammonium nitrate, as a reportable chemical under risk management planning. The EPA did not do that. It is my guess is it's going to happen this time after the West fertilizer explosion. But the one of the things we found out within a very short period through the Freedom of Information Act was that within hours of the West explosion, the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees chemical plant safety, had disavowed any responsibility for never having inspected West fertilizer. They had their reading of their regulations was that this was not a plant that required their scrutiny. That was news. And I have to credit my friends at the EPA for having gotten me the first batch of emails under my FOIA request very quickly, ahead of the deadline, as a matter of fact. Within a week of my first request, I have my first batch of emails. I had requested expedited processing, and they granted that, and were very, very swift. And, of course, they delivered those. You know, all the EPA FOIA stuff is now delivered via the web. And so once you get it, everybody else can get it. But at the same time, unless they're looking for it, they're probably not going to find it. I've never been scooped by somebody off my own request that way. But the point is, the process of deciding what is and is not confidential information is very controversial. It came up again after West. For official purposes, the risk management plan was not available to the public in any way that was readily accessible, and in fact, some of the details are not available at all. The premise being some of those Ukrainian terrorists who are sneaking from ISIS, who are sneaking across the border of Texas, according to our governor, were going to go to West Texas and decide to set a fertilizer warehouse on fire and blow it up so they could kill a bunch of people. That's ludicrous, of course, but that is one of the criteria for keeping that information secret. The what really happens, of course, is that the public who lives around the place has no idea it's there because they don't have access to that information. And so what's more likely that a tossed cigarette or a faulty wire is going to cause a warehouse explosion, or that terrorists are going to sneak in and blow it up? There's a high price being paid in public safety for this kind of restriction of information, frankly, in the name of public safety. Something has got to be resolved on this.
I want to follow up on that, because we had a discussion here yesterday about FOIA, and one of the things that we said is that one of the great faults is how long it takes to get the information. But you should be aware that there is a provision for expedited processing, and it has to do with, if you are a journalist, it's pretty much specifically for journalists, as I remember, If you're going to be disseminating information to the public about an immediate threat, you can make an argument that they need to put you at the front of the line. And I want to ask you, Randy, what was the argument you made in your expedited processing request?
Yes, it was exactly that. It was as a matter of urgency. That's a magic word you have to use in your request, and it's a matter of public safety is a very important thing to point out. Specifically, the expedited processing was intended. The language was meant to say, if somebody's going to die if you don't publish this information. That's never how it really works. What really happens is that we make an argument that is a matter of overwhelming urgency, and the public has to know this information immediately to take action on an imminent crisis. And so it's not really a matter of life and death. It's really a matter of people have to know right now because they have to take action to make their communities safer. And like I said, use those magic words. There's lots of FOIA resources on the web that will help you craft that. There are form letters, all sorts of things. You have to go through very specific, seemingly redundant and silly steps to get your FOIA in perfect shape. But it's worth the extra 20 minutes it takes to do that.
Just anecdotally, to show you how the politics are kind of intensifying in the Toledo water crisis, I got a tip that I did a big story on the records, a very strong paper trail showing that the administration was less than candid about the state of the water plant, and that the water plant was running into a lot of regular maintenance operational issues that weren't directly related to algae treatment, but nonetheless, it's a 73-year-old water plant that was having a lot of problems. And so I was, I got a tip from somebody, and I called down to the Ohio EPA's Deputy Director of Communications, and I said, was this a report that when they were going to try to get more, rate hikes, or does this ring a bell? Do you know what people are talking about? And finally he just said, are you putting this in the form of a FOIA request? And I said, okay, if you want to go that route, I'll put it down. Tell me who to send it to. He goes, I can take it verbally over the phone. And I said, okay, let's do any and all correspondence, emails and everything else, going back at least through, 2010, knowing that 2011 was the record bloom. He goes, okay, you got it. Lo and behold, I had no idea. This was the most recent time I was out at the water plant. These guys were going way past their shift, meeting me out there at 5 o'clock to spend 2.5 hours going through the latest plans for a Sunday story I was working on. I get a call from my boss at 7 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, just after I left to go out to the water plant, the Ohio EPA had electronically transmitted nearly 500 pages. How many times have you ever had a FOIA request verbally submitted and filled the same day, 500 pages? And so they said, hurry up and get back fast. And I got a phone call from the Deputy Director of Communications at 7 o'clock saying, Tom, it's 7 o'clock. I sent this to you at 5 o'clock. I really thought I would start getting some questions from you by now, and I'm about ready to go home. And so we both talked, my managing editor and I talked about this. Obviously, somebody wanted to get that into our hands, but the records speak for themselves. If you see how damning some of the, some of the letters are, especially a pointed one from the Ohio EPA director directly to the mayor on June 9th saying that, I fear that your plant is in quote-unquote imminent vulnerability to a catastrophic failure. And, there was a strong paper trail there. It wasn't just one or two things. And it just, I don't know. You don't get that very often, but as my managing editor and I, said, the records speak for themselves, whether somebody was motivated to get in our hands or not.
Oh, yes.
I'm Kylie Crow with Climate Progress in DC, and I have a question. Maybe it's best for Randy or Tom. Do you have any tips for covering either, you know, whether it's a breaking event or it's a longer story when you're not there on the ground and you don't have, you know, maybe the Rolodex that Tom has and the people in his cell phone to call, but obviously you want to print verified information or get statements from people there. So if you guys had any tips for how to do that.
Curiously, in the entire year we spent intensely covering the West fertilizer explosion, I never went there. We had plenty of reporters down there at the scene, and the reason I didn't go was a very personal one. I covered the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, and I was in a pool one night that was taken up inside the building, and we're watching the dogs look for bodies and all of this, and it really had an effect on me. And for 15 years after that, I really couldn't see a picture of the old building itself without really having that kind of shock. So I just simply got over my disaster scene desires. So, but I sat there in Dallas for a year and was able to work sources and frankly, the internet. The internet's a terrific resource. If you're not covering a very, very local situation, you know, like your water plant or like your local thing blows up, you don't need an extensive Rolodex to cover an issue. What you have to do, though, is start developing that Rolodex really, really fast. Always ask somebody, if you get somebody on the phone, ask who else might know something about this. And every time you do that, you ask that person the same thing. And eventually, somebody's going to give you the golden ring. And that's how it's done, because all the people we deal with tend to know all the other people we deal with. And they're all exchanging information. They're all sending emails to each other and calling each other right away. They're saying, hey, did you hear what happened and all of this? And so eventually, it gets around to people who really know what they're talking about. So use the network. Use the network the same way the people you're covering use it within their own world.
So yeah, and I worked at the Wires pre-internet and almost pre-fax, and so we would have big stories breaking, and it is really about just calling everybody you can possibly think of, about you know, and I think that's good advice to ask them what they know then.
Also, pay attention to any emails you get to see who else is emailed.
The tip. Yeah, the tip is to look at the if you're getting emails, see who's getting CC'd and follow up with them. Okay, other questions, comments?
Michael Martz from the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I wanted to follow up on the 911 issue. It's become a big factor in the oil trains because of the right to know. There was an emergency order that the DOT issued in May after the derailment Lynchburg, and there had been a series of derailments, requiring the railroads to provide certain information to the state emergency response councils, which then disseminated to the local. But then there was a provision for confidentiality that the railroads, and CSX, for example, required that the state agencies and local responders keep this information confidential. In Virginia, ultimately, the state released it. They said there's nothing really confidential, but Norfolk Southern sued the state of Maryland over it, and I think Louisiana, the Jindal administration, also ordered it kept confidential. So I gather that with the oil, it's treated a little different from some of the hazardous chemicals under SARA and others, the right to know. And the lawyer from the DOJ last night said that, you know, the oil is considered a hazardous waste, and that gets into liability issues. What's your take on that, how that story is emerging?
I'm going to actually take that one because we've had a lot of discussion of coal trains in the Northwest. I have not covered it because Investigate West specifically doesn't cover stuff that a lot of people are covering. But I followed the discussion, and we had the same very same situation where the railroads turned over the records but said, you can't show these to anybody. And thank goodness the state said, yes, we can. and I don't actually know where that went. Cassandra, do you know any? Have you been following that at all? Very state to state. Exactly, exactly. But I'm glad that Virginia and Louisiana and Washington. No,
Louisiana didn't do it.
Did not. Oh, Virginia okay. Did. I see. Okay, that's a little more about what I would have expected. Oil is of course regulated under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. The kind of thing that went up in West is regulated under RCRA. So that's another thing. If you're on a big breaking story. Remember that, I mean, make yourself into an investigative reporter, okay? And there's two kinds of investigative reporting. One is is the basic one, and this is the one that you want to use in this case. It's just, what do the regulations say, and did they follow it? And so, go read the relevant regulations. Yes, you're on deadline. Yes, they're boring and hard to get through, but it's worth looking at. Any other advice from the audience about that? Nope, okay. Have a question, a comment, Joe?
Well, Joe Davis, I'm with SEJ. I do freedom of information stuff, and because of that, I'm always interested in, kind of the topic of this is what you do when you can't get the information straight out right away from the government, and yeah. So it seems to me that one of the problems with these breaking disasters is you never know where they're coming from, and most of these were unexpected, although. Told them so, and other people told them so too, but so I'm trying to because each one is different. I'm wishing to generalize, or wishing for you guys to generalize about. Okay, so what can you do to be prepared? What can you do when you can't get the information? And I think what I'm hearing here is, it's just basic reporting. Call everyone and that kind of stuff. It's really shoe leather, and it's. Work the beat like Tom does. He has the good sources because he's covering it every day. And then I'm hearing and build relationships, right? And so even when you can't get it from some official sources or PIOs, sometimes you have trust relationships with PIOs or others in the government who actually will talk to you because they pretty much know you're not going to burn them. So I would really like to hear other generalizations, but I don't know what they are, but maybe you
I've
guys
got one. Now, thanks, Joe. Just saying. As much as I'm interested in what people say, I'm much more interested in what they do. And as much as I'm interested in what they say, I'm much more interested in what they wrote down. And the documents tell you a whole lot more than you could imagine. Really careful, nuanced reading of documents that seem really boring frequently the truth will leap out at you, and that then becomes a way of going back to your sources. But a lot of times, I simply can't find anybody who knows the answer to the exact question I have. But it's in a document somewhere. And if you just keep digging, if you read down to the final chapter of that 600-page EIS or whatever it is, you're going to find something really fascinating that's going to jump out at you. So, real quick, when I worked for the Miami Herald, Interior Secretary James Watt decided he wanted to drill for oil on the Florida Keys. Every Republican and Democrat in Florida was opposed to that. We finally got an environmental impact statement on their proposal, and at the very bottom of the thing, literally after 600 pages, pardon me, was a statement that, yes, if there's a major oil spill in the Keys, it will really mess up the tourism, which is 100% of the economy in the Keys. However, this will be partially offset by the expenditures of officials, oil cleanup workers, and the news media coming in response to the spill. So, of course, you know that my lead was James Watt has good news and bad news for the Keys. I'm a real believer in reading down to the fine print, because somebody has put something like that, either silly, and of course that reveals their mindset. They're trying to justify this thing, but it also sometimes you find the golden egg right there in the middle of the pile of garbage.
I think this is. I also have a tip, and it's one that Joe. You're right. It's everything we're talking about doing on deadline is what you do as a reporter anyway. And one is, and this seems like it takes too long, but pull out an Excel spreadsheet and start putting together a timeline of everything you do know, and then start and then add to that as you go along.
Enormously important.
Yeah. Start a timeline, and this timeline starts 1990 Oil Pollution Act. You know, just put down what you do know and build that timeline as you keep on going through. Tom,
yeah. Mark,
no, I think you hit it on the head, Joe, when you said shoe leather reporting. In the Davis Bessie case, for one example, and that was back the story broke 12 years ago. Now there's a plant insider, and I love engineers because they're kind of geeky and stuff like that. But this is the guy who became an inside source for me, and he's privy to a lot of documents that come and go. Well, actually, every document that comes and goes, and we've had an agreement not to even say what's the weather like if we see each other at a public meeting, but we correspond all the time. He calls me out of the blue all the time, even today, continues to tell me, and sometimes it's just like, I went to go see this movie on such and such, and I had expectation, and I'm on deadline, I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, and it's just, you go through, and you take the effort, and you get to develop these sources, and they'll keep coming back to you. This same guy, he underwent a stress test one time, and he had some documents, and his wife thought he was having a heart attack, but he wanted me to meet him in the emergency room so he could hand over these documents. And yeah, it's pretty amazing. But in the case of the Toledo water plant, our mayor said to our editorial director and our executive editor, we had a meeting, and he said, there's one reporter I talked to behind the scenes, and he pointed to me. He goes, that's the only guy on this great little piece of technology here that you can see how sophisticated my cell phone here, one of the old flip phones. I have the cell phone number of Mayor Michael Collins, and we were talking all the time, and how's different things. He'd be like, God, it's a long day. And after 14 hours one day, I think on that Saturday, we were talking from 12 to 1:30 in the morning, and he was going through some of the things that I went through, and other, he gets a little punchy and starts talking about personal stuff and everything. But you just keep talking to him, and he goes, I'll see you in about 5 hours at the press conference and so forth. But we the last day when they were about to announce, I said, they decided to move up the press conference. I said, can you just hold off for another 10 minutes? And I did something I'm not supposed to do. I text and drove. But as I'm driving, I said, my ETA now is 9:21. Can you hold off? And lo and behold, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but they held off. And I got there in time for the press conference. But a lot of it just comes down to, like you're saying, Joe, just shoe leather reporting, working sources, getting to know people. I've had, the former mayor, Cardi Finkbeiner. I was stunned one day. He called me up out of the blue, and Mark probably knows about this project. I think it was a $75 million project. It was a Superfund cleanup of the Ottawa River. All they're waiting on, all the US EPA money was there, and to start the actual project, they needed the city of Toledo to sign off on on the agreement. And Cardi calls me up, and he says, Tommy, he goes, I got the lawyers here, you're on a conference call. He goes, they want me to sign off. I know we've been talking about this thing over and over. He goes, you know more about dredging than anybody. He goes, this is a good thing, bad thing. And I said, Cardi, as a reporter, I cannot advise you how to spend $75 million of taxpayers' money. And he goes, cut the bullshit. He goes, you know more about this than anyone else. He goes, I want to know right now, what do you think? What should I do? And I said, Cardi, all I'm going to tell you is the public record is very clear. If you don't sign it, the US EPA is prepared to take you to federal court and essentially, you know, I said, but I'm not advised. Oh, yes, you are. You just gave me the answer. Thank you very much. You know, and I, you know. But that's just, you know, that's, like I said, it just gets back to kind of developing relationships, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yep, the, right. Right, absolutely. Well, and that's why a lot of why SEJ is here, is to help people who have to parachute in. That's kind of why we do this.
What he said.
Yeah, and I know we have another question or two, but I meant to ask Mark earlier was, just, you know, for people who are showing up on the scene, they don't have a deep Rolodex, they don't have documents, they're on the scene, they're actually physically at the JIC. What are the two or three things you would advise to reporters who are talking to PIOs and others at the JIC?
I think one of the things is, again, this is Mark McIntyre at EPA. One of the things that would really help strengthen relationships between PIOs and reporters is when, after maybe a subject matter expert, you're set up with somebody who can talk about a specific thing. At the end of the conversation, if you can reframe, if you can go ahead and sort of recover what you just heard and say, here's what I heard you guys say, and sort of go back to them with what, you know, what your the premise is, that's invaluable. And it helps, again, make sure the relationship is good, because it helps us know that you know that we know that you know. And I think also a tip that I would give to reporters is to see at any incident, one of the best people you'll be able to talk to, if you can arrange it, is the deputy incident commander, because in the ICS system, there's always the incident commander or the head of unified command. And by the construct, the deputy incident commander needs to be able to walk into that role should the incident commander go down, face down. But until that happens, the deputy incident commander really doesn't do much other than listen to what's going on. So they have to be at that same level of situational awareness, and so they're a great source for information. They can also be really good for interviews on camera because they're not being whipsawed around in all these meetings. Mostly the incident command system is a way to occupy everybody's time 24/7 because you're always going to the next meeting. And then I think the other piece I would do is the other suggestion I would make is just to work with the PIO, make sure that if there are opportunities presented that and you say you're going to be in a certain place at a certain time, sometimes it's a Herculean effort to get everybody there, and I know everybody has the best intentions, but show up if you say you're going to do something or you say you want to interview somebody. Because if a PIO, I'll tell you the fastest way to ruin your relationship with a PIO is to get them to get somebody, extract somebody from some horrible place and then not turn up or turn up 25 minutes late. That can be a real relationship killer. One last thing I will add is I think the idea of going on tours of plants is fantastic. If you can call your friendly PIO at either your POTW, your water treatment plant, your drinking water treatment facility, if you're near a dam, a river with dams, go to the locks. Any place where you think there could be a horrible thing happening, go to a rail yard, talk to the PIO and say, hey, I'd just like to go and do a tour. You will have such incredible situational awareness when the bell rings. You'll be way ahead of everybody else.
One really important tip that I forgot all about, but it's invaluable, SEJ talk. If there's a breaking story, there's graybeards all over the country who've covered this. So even if you're not on SEJ talk because of the volume or whatever, when a big daily breaker comes, get on there and start asking questions. You'll get answers right away.
And
And real quick, just to amplify what Mark said here, I was going to say too, when you visit a water treatment plant, a nuclear plant, if you any kind of thing that involves a lot of technology, think of it in terms of baby steps. I mean, don't just say you're going to go there one time and get photos and come back. It's an information overload. You got to kind of digest this. I think usually about 3 to 4 different visits spaced out over time, you'll start to really absorb and digest it. It'll really start to make sense after a while. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense the first time you go out there just because it's so overwhelming and it's so big. Just seeing the sequence of how things work is a little more difficult. One thing I wanted to add to though with Mark too, with the Kalamazoo River oil spill, and this was a good example. Mark works on the West Coast, but he was brought out for that. I haven't had a whole lot of direct dealing with him, but I guess my name must have gotten around the agency enough that when I showed up on the scene, partly because I know how to talk to PIOs and everything, just be as specific as you can about how they can help and what your needs are, because the oil spill for us is in the Great Lakes region, but it's not in our circulation area, so we weren't going to cover it blow by blow, but basically I went there to do a couple of daily stories and then do a big Sunday takeout, and I went to Mark, and I just said, when I got there, and it's a big chaotic scene, I said, look, I got about 24 hours here. I got to get down to the heart of the thing. What can you do? And he immediately just said, I can try to get this going. He goes, let's make it happen. And he did. You know, at a very, where time was of the essence for me, all the TV and everybody was hanging out around the command center. They're taking me down into, you know, down near where the pipeline ruptured and getting, you know, some visuals and getting, you know, access. And that really helped. But I know it sounds very basic, but just try to, sometimes people, I think reporters a tendency, think of PIOs as obstructionists. But if you can think of them more as, you know, what they're there for, to be, you know, to assist you and try to, streamline things. So.
Okay, we're out of time. Thank you for coming.